This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Today we look at an unsuccessful attempt by a well-intentioned healthcare service to stop an elderly Tasmanian amputee from living on his yacht.
Well, that's absolutely what came out of the judgment was that, you know, this was his home. It was what was important to him. He didn't have a lot of friends. It was what he did. He lived on his yacht. And the gravity of taking away his right to make that decision was significant.
Just because some experts thought he was too frail to live on his yacht, did that mean he'd lost his marbles and he needed a guardian to make decisions for him? That's coming up later. First, to the other end of the age and health spectrum, the youthful, super-fit, hyper-connected world of social media influencers.
We actually went back to the loft and ate dinner at the loft, so we got a parma and tacos and bruschetta.
That's social influencer Chloe Roberts informing her followers about the culinary delights she discovered on a recent trip to Bali.
Definitely recommend going there. The parma was amazing.
Social media influencers. You might think of them as a bit shallow and silly, but this is seriously a big industry. Last week, a Melbourne cafe owner was ordered to pay $1,600 to Instagram influencer Chloe Roberts for posts which promoted his eating establishment. Of course, this was a minor small claims dispute. But in reaching its decision, the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal had to apply the law to the business practices and the business norms of this only recently invented but now huge business. Professor Melissa Deswart is Dean of Law at the University of Adelaide. Melissa Deswart, for those who don't know, what is a social media influencer?
It's an interesting question. A social media influencer is someone who attracts a certain number, and depending on what industry you're in, of followers on a platform such as Instagram. So, you know, if you have, say, 100,000 followers on Instagram, you might be able to monetize or market your account because you have the capacity to influence, to advertise, to sway all of those people who are following you on social media.
And people make a living out of this, right?
Absolutely they do. So we have a number of millionaires already in Australia who have built up their business on Instagram or on YouTube through something like selling a fitness plan or clothing or food, so that they are paid money and they are also given a huge number of products, essentially to do product placement on their social media account.
Okay, let's focus in on this decision last week from the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Who is Chloe Roberts? Who brought the claim?
So she is one of these social media influencers. So she essentially can go to a business and say, look, I can present you or your products in such a way that it appears that I am using your products or enjoying your service, and my followers will think, gee, that's a great thing. I want to be there. So she was able to monetize her account by placing selected posts on her feed saying that she was at a particular place.
And she is, I think, she describes herself as a gym and fitness ambassador, and her Instagram account features lots of shots, lots of photos of her in bikinis and G-strings, and she's often pictured with food or working out on the beach, right?
Yeah, and that's a fairly sort of common type of influencer. Again, as I said, a lot of the ones who have been most successful in Australia have built up their accounts through this sort of appeal to that particular demographic of, you know, young people who are conscious of health and fitness and also style, and so she appeals to that demographic.
Okay, and she has 123,000 followers, so she's a popular person. Now, tell me, who is Con Katsianis?
So he's a cafe owner who was entered into an agreement with her to publicised, for her to make posts about enjoying food at his cafe in Melbourne.
And he employed Chloe, I think, originally at $200 a post, but then that increased to $300 when the number of her followers increased from, I think, 80,000 up to 223,000. So what was this dispute about? They had, what, a verbal agreement that he would pay her $200 or $300 a pop?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing too about the way in which this industry is evolving. So industry statistics tell us now that advertising on social media platforms like Instagram is actually, there's now more money being spent on that than in what we'd call mainstream media, you know, TV or print media, for example. But the nature of the relationship is very casual. So as you said, you know, the amount he paid was essentially per post, depends on how many followers you have. But the terms of that agreement were, of course, uncertain. So the issue that caused the dispute here was that the posts were made, but they are then deleted after a certain period of time. And so that was what caused the dispute, not that the posts hadn't been made, but they had been removed. And he had an expectation that essentially they would stay on her account. Big question then, stay on her account for how long? Indefinitely. But what we know about the way in which social media is used is that users are very careful about maintaining their account in a way that looks fresh and will often go back and delete posts that either no longer match their image or that are just simply expired in their mind.
But cafe owner Con Katsianis says, "I'm not going to pay for posts that you've deleted." Chloe Roberts responds by saying 90% of posts are viewed within the first week, and it's not a good look for me or for you to have too many similar posts or photos. So is she saying this detracts from the image I'm trying to project out into the world?
Absolutely. So influencers are very much about what is fresh, what is new, and you know, a lot of this really gets into this issue about what is the evolving etiquette or the evolving norms of the use of social media. So people want to groom their account so that it looks like the imagery is up to the minute in terms of trends. Accounts are meant to be sort of kept curated and fresh. And so that was her reason is, well, I don't want to be someone who has a whole lot of old posts sitting there. And of course, I think partly her argument was that the older posts might, in essence, compete with the newer ones or create some inconsistency.
So and I guess it's the idea is that it detracts from a sense that this is an influencer who's having a fantastic, authentic life full of new experiences. And if you keep scrolling down the screen and you see similar posts for the same business, that kind of somewhat detracts from that idea. You realise that you're just seeing a series of advertorials.
That's right. So a lot of the appeal of social media is this notion, this facade even, that what you are looking at is authentic. Okay, so you're absolutely right. If you see the same bowl of muesli, you know, appearing routinely once a week, or if there's anything about it that betrays, that breaks through that sense of authenticity, then it's clear, yeah, this person is just actually flogging this particular product or this particular place. So why things have that vibe about them is that it has to have that freshness. It's like, wow, look what I just discovered. Look what I have found. And, you know, you too could come here and get some of this fresh, happening vibe. So it must have that sense of veracity, that this is a living experience, not just a placement of various products.
I'm going to be doing a video today on something that I'm so excited to share with you guys, and you guys should be excited too, because this is actually something that could change your lives in such an amazing way.
So what did the tribunal find? It found in favour of Chloe Roberts, largely.
Yes, because of the, I think, you know, the lack of clarity of terms. So if you think about if this was a traditional sort of advertising contract, you would know how many times a post would appear, how long it would be there. You'd have this issue of how many views it would have. And essentially they recognised that there was sort of vagary about what the agreement was, and that she had essentially met her side of the bargain. The post had been there and had been there for a period of time that she, as essentially I suppose you could call her the business operator, had deemed appropriate, and then had been removed. So there was no expectation that it be permanently there.
So the tribunal member ordered that Con Katsiyanis, the cafe owner, pay Roberts $1,400 or $1,600 or two-thirds of what she was seeking, which I think included the filing fees. So do you reckon this was a case of the cafe owner not understanding the business model of the influencer? What do you think was going on here? It's hard to know.
I think there's a bit of the issue of the gig economy creeping in here too. So, you know, what was he paying her a few hundred dollars per post for exactly? And, you know, and the belief, I suppose, that he had that was what he was entitled to. And it's very, very ambiguous. What does $300 or $500 or $800 get you in terms of putting a post up on social media? And I think that the case really recognises that, in fact, the relationship was more of a business relationship than just you're one of my top customers, I'm happy to pay you a bit of money to make me look good. You know, it's that weird borderline between something that is a business and something that is just recognising that you're doing me a favour almost.
Melissa Deswart, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
No problem at all. Thanks, Damien.
On RN or available as a podcast, this is the Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. If you make a decision that a group of experts thinks is unwise or dangerous, does that mean you've lost your marbles or you should no longer be allowed to make your own choices? Well, that question was at the heart of a recent court case in Hobart. The Supreme Court of Tasmania has handed down a ruling in favour of an elderly man who's only known as Jay. Jay succeeded in convincing the judge to overturn a decision of the Tasmanian Guardianship and Administration Board, which had appointed a guardian to control his affairs. Kate Hanslow is a Hobart lawyer, and she's also a researcher with the Tasmanian Law Reform Institute. Kate, who is this man, Jay? What do we know about him?
Jay was an elderly gentleman who, it seems, had lived a fairly private life, fairly sort of recluse, didn't have a lot of friends. He lived his life on a yacht and had undertaken some works to convert that into his home, and that was where he lived.
And a little while ago, his yacht actually ran aground in a storm, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it appears there was a storm, and it, for whatever reason, led to him attending a pharmacist, at which point they recommended that he take himself off to hospital with a suspected gangrene foot, and certainly that was the diagnosis. And despite their efforts to treat that, ultimately the gentleman had to have his leg amputated above the knee.
That's terrible. So the right leg is amputated above the knee. And then what happens at that point as he begins his recovery?
He certainly had a period of time in hospital while it appears that he undertook some treatment, of course. It reached the point where, you know, he was soon to be able to be discharged from hospital. And the question then arose as to whether or not he could return to living on his yacht. And so as part of that process, there were some occupational therapists and a social worker who went to his yacht to assess that, to see whether or not it would be suitable, obviously, because of his change in physical circumstances. And they assessed the yacht and determined that, in their opinion, there really wasn't a way that there could be modifications done to make that yacht safe for him, because he was at the time subject to being in a wheelchair. So that was the advice that he was given.
But he makes it super clear that he intends to return to his yacht, his home. That's what he wants to do. And I think he says, look, I'll park it in a marina and everything will be okay. I'm up for this.
That's right. I mean, he was absolutely adamant that it was his home, and, you know, he lived there. It was his lifestyle. He was very comfortable there and he did not want to contemplate circumstances where he wasn't able to return, and was just absolutely adamant that despite the advice that he was being given, that he did want to return to his home on the yacht, despite his medical condition.
Okay, so the occupational therapist and the physiotherapist, they say, we don't think you can return safely to the yacht. Those treating him at the hospital have concerns. What do they do at this point?
What's occurred is one of the social workers at the hospital has made an application to the Guardianship and Administration Board, seeking the appointment of a guardian for the gentleman to make decisions about where he was to live, on the basis that it was their opinion that he didn't have the ability to make those decisions for himself, as evidenced by the fact that he, you know, was having this fixated position that he did want to return to the yacht despite it being the advice that it wasn't safe. So they've made an application to the Guardianship and Administration Board, and the board then heard the matter and ultimately decided that a guardian should be appointed.
So essentially the hospital wants to force Jay to go into some kind of what, supported accommodation, or at least accommodation on land, conventional accommodation on land, and definitely not return to his yacht. What is the competing evidence which is heard at this board hearing?
Well, we had conflicting medical evidence presented both for and against the view that Jay had a disability that meant that he was unable to make decisions.
So a cognitive disability, right? No, nothing to do with the amputation
correct.
Of his leg.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's correct. A disability that affected his ability to make a decision. So typically, well, certainly it's the standard procedure that when a person files an application to the Guardianship and Administration Board, they must file with that application a healthcare professional report, and that's a standard form that sets out the nature of the application and the evidence put forward to establish the test that the person has a disability and that that disability means that they can't make a decision. So that healthcare professional report was submitted, as is standard practice, and one of the questions on that form is, does the proposed represented person have a disability? And that box was ticked. It stated that the gentleman had cognitive impairments, that he lacked insight and had poor judgment and poor decision-making skills, and very much it would seem that the focus was on those poor judgments being demonstrated by his refusal to accept the medical advice. So that was the first piece of evidence.
In other words, the fact that he wants to go back to the yacht, and he's, to use their terms, fixated on that, indicates that he's unable to make good decisions and therefore needs a guardian.
The types of decisions can be a relevant factor, but yes, it does seem that that was the focus in demonstrating the lack of ability to make decisions. So that was the first piece of evidence. And then the Royal Hobart Hospital had also had a psychologist who had assessed Jay, and one of the interesting and critical factors was that Jay really didn't want to participate in cognitive assessments and medical assessments because he was quite concerned that that evidence was later going to be used in a Guardianship and Administration Board hearing. So he perhaps didn't comply with their requests to undergo assessments, and that made it difficult for them to provide medical evidence. There was no neuropsychological evidence. There was, you know, no cognitive assessments per se. It was all largely based on their observations in the clinical setting where they'd observed him on a number of different occasions. So this psychologist had given evidence that Jay had quite rambling speech, that in his opinion, Jay wasn't able to weigh up the consequences and implications of his actions, and again referred to him having limited insight about his medical conditions. So the psychologist concluded that there was likely some form of cognitive impairment, but didn't go as far as saying that he actually did have a disability, and that necessarily that disability then affected his ability to make a decision.
And Jay also had his own expert witnesses as well, didn't he?
Exactly. So, yeah, Jay, it seems along the way, has engaged his own geriatrician to provide a report. And so he has complied with that assessment, obviously, because that was on his terms and he'd engaged that specialist. So The geriatrician provided competing evidence against what had been submitted in the application and said that, in her opinion, she couldn't find evidence of cognitive impairment, that Jay had performed quite well on a mini mental test and had, to her, demonstrated insight about his condition. And she put forward some other evidence that sort of suggested that he, was making good decisions as well as this perceived bad decision. He had above average problem solving skills. And then she commented on some of his personality traits and perhaps those features that might have been misinterpreted, in her opinion, to suggest that he had cognitive impairment. So things that, like, he spoke quite quickly, that he hadn't led a conventional life and that he didn't have a lot of friends, that sometimes he could be long-winded, but they didn't necessarily indicate a cognitive impairment.
So he's a quirky, headstrong individual.
That would be sort of what sort of comes through the judgment, yes. I mean, I suppose that's what her observations were, that they were more personality trait characteristics as opposed to necessarily a cognitive impairment.
So, Kate Hanslow, the board did appoint a guardian, but Jay was not happy with this, and he's obviously a man with some means, so he appealed the ruling to the Supreme Court of Tasmania, and that decision was just handed down very recently. What did Justice Wood decide to do, and for what reason?
So Justice Wood ultimately determined that there was insufficient evidence of a disability and insufficient evidence that any disability was affecting Jay's ability to make a decision. And she also determined that there was no need for a guardian in the circumstances. So on all of the grounds that Jay had put forward in appealing the decision, he was successful. Justice Wood looked at the fact that there was an inconclusive finding. There was a presumption of cognitive impairment, but no actual definitive diagnosis of a disability.
So what's the big picture take-home message from this decision?
I think there's a lot of really important points, and fundamentally what Justice Wood was really clear on emphasising is a person's ability to make their own decision, and then the need for personal autonomy and a person's right to make decisions, and particularly decisions about where a person is to live and their lifestyle, is so fundamental to a person's human rights. So that really needs to be the focus. But I think she also looked at the fact that, you know, we all should be able to make unwise decisions and act contrary to advice if we want to, and that is our right. Everyone needs to have the right to make a bad decision. And just because somebody's making a bad decision, we need to not take an overly paternalistic approach to protect that person or ensure their safety, that if that's their decision and they are able to make that decision, then that should be it.
People are entitled to make decisions in the best interests as they see them, rather than somebody, you know, superimposing upon them what they think is in their best interest.
Yeah, very much. And so we've got these overriding guiding principles of the Act, and one of those is that we do need to promote a person's best interests, but balanced with that is the fact that we do need to take into account people's wishes and be as least restrictive as possible, because when we're appointing a guardian, we're taking away a person's right to make their own decision about fundamental things like where they live. So we do need to exercise some caution and really only do it in the most extreme circumstances where it's necessary.
I mean, what was basically what the judge saying was, look, the hospital was trying to shoehorn its concerns about his physical safety into some kind of definition of him, or some kind of finding of him as having sort of cognitive disabilities or deficits, when really he just had a resolute and fixed determination to live in his home, and that doesn't mean he's not all there.
Yeah, I think what Justice Wood was really emphasising is that there's cause and effect, and, you know, the effect and what seemed to be given focus was the fact that he was making what was perceived by the hospital as being a poor decision. But really we need to look at whether or not he can make decisions, what the cause is, and if there's an underlying impairment that means that he can't make the decision, or if it's merely the fact that he's, you know, exercising his right to make a decision as he sees fit.
Mm. Kate Hanslow, do you have any idea about how Jay is travelling now?
I don't, I'm afraid. Sorry, no. No, but I mean, the judgment did sort of indicate that he had had improvements with his health and medical condition, and he was at the time of the hearing taking steps to try and have some modifications made to his yacht so that he could return. But no, I'm afraid I can't give much more information.
Things such as always having an alarm on him just in case he was incapacitated or had an accident, sort of taking sort of precautions.
Seemed like, you know, whilst there did seem to be an emphasis on the poor decision of wanting to return to the yacht, there was also evidence put forward at the hearing that, yeah, he was getting an alarm so that he could be safe on the yacht and have access to support if he needed it. He purchased a smartwatch so that, again, he had access to communication tools if he needed them. And he had engaged a private occupational therapist to give him some advice about how modifications could be made. And at that stage, he had perhaps acknowledged that, you know, if all of these alternatives are exhausted and there's no other alternative, then perhaps he might need to seek alternative arrangements. But he certainly was seeking to pursue other options first.
Mm. And it'd be lovely to know how he's doing now, but he doesn't really want to talk to the media or have his lawyers talk. So unfortunately, that remains a mystery. Now, look, Kate Hanslow, in your capacity as a researcher with the Tasmanian Law Reform Institute, you wrote a review of the Tasmanian Guardianship and Administration Act 1995, and that was released, I think, or completed. That process was completed late last year. When you were trying to work out how well this act works and whether we've got the balance right between these issues of you know, autonomy on the one hand and best interests on the other, what were people telling you as you went about this process?
Well, I suppose from one perspective, certainly there was a lot of individuals and stakeholders in the area that were saying, you know, this is, for its time, it was quite a contemporary piece of legislation and it has served Tasmanians well. But on the flip side, certainly there was strong support for removal of some of these sort of paternalistic notions of best interests on the basis that, you know, it does result in protectionist attitudes and a focus too much on a person's safety as opposed to their right to make a decision. So one of the things that we recommended in our report is removal of the preconditional, the elements of best interests tests within the Act, so that very much the focus is on a person's views and wishes, you know, wherever possible.
Mm. Do other jurisdictions have a different model or see things in less black and white terms?
I think we're all, to a degree, going through processes of legislative reform at the moment. So there's varying levels across the country and it is state-based legislation. So we have quite different models within each jurisdiction. We have had some reforms in Queensland recently and there's a debate ongoing in Victoria as we speak, I think, about some reforms to their Guardianship Administration Act. So we are starting to see some reforms and those are all very much consistent with removal of the best interests approach and an approach based on the person's views and wishes. And that's consistent with our obligations under Australia having ratified the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
Kate Hanslow from the Tasmanian Law Reform Institute. She conducted a recent review of Tasmania's Guardianship and Administration Act. And look, a few hours ago, I received an email from Jay's lawyers with some bittersweet news. The sweet news? Jay is indeed living on his boat and enjoying his freedom. The bitter news? The Tasmanian Health Service is appealing the decision that secured that freedom. So unfortunately for Jay, this legal saga is set to continue. Jay, an elderly man, will continue to have to channel his money and his energy into this litigation over whether or not he should be able to make his own decisions. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer this week, Selwyn Cousins. Don't forget, you can listen to the Law Report anytime, any place by subscribing to the podcast, either at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.